I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, we will talk more about the story that's riveted the country, about those three women who were missing for a decade, who were recently found alive. In a few minutes, we'll speak with a local columnist who stayed in touch with the mother of one of the missing women who never gave up hope, but sadly did not live to see her daughter free. We'll hear more from columnist Regina Brett. But first, we want to talk about another issue that has gripped this country for years now, and that is immigration. The Senate has now started its intense work on a sweeping immigration reform bill that was put forward by a bipartisan group. On nearly 850 pages, the bill lays out sweeping changes to exactly how and when immigrants would be allowed to enter the U.S. But while a lot of attention has focused on conservative objections to what some are calling amnesty for the millions of undocumented people who are already here, there's also a vigorous debate among progressives, including among African-American leaders. So we decided to invite two of those leaders to share their thoughts. With us now are writer, economist, and former college president Julian Malveaux. Also with us, Hillary Shelton. He's the Washington Bureau Director for the NAACP. That's the well-known National Civil Rights Group. Welcome to you both. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Great to be with you.
Julian, I'm going to start with you. You wrote a column calling this bill a, quote, 844-page monstrosity. What are your major objections?
Every senator in the Gang of Eight has put in special provisions for themselves. Meanwhile, this bill essentially eliminates the diversity visa program, which is how most African or Caribbean immigrants came in. The new program, a point system, makes it much more difficult for Africans and Caribbeans to come here, so it's an implicit discrimination. Also, Senator Schumer got an exception so that 10,000 Irish people can come. No one has explained why except for special interests, but no one's got such a provision for either Africans or Caribbeans. So Lindsey Graham gets extra folks in for a meatpacking industry. There's a provision for ski employees, for cruise ships, and nothing for people of African descent.
Well, so just to clarify, Senator Lindsey Graham's from South Carolina. Senator Chuck Schumer is from New York. And it's a specific position you're talking about. It seems to advantage Irish people with a high school diploma. And you ask, you know, why that is. Let me ask you, Professor Malveaux, do you think that this is intentionally race-based? Or do you think that this is just a byproduct of people seeking advantages for particular constituents of their own?
I don't think it's intentional race-based. I think that they tried to put together the best bill they could, although 844 pages, I haven't been able to read it without getting a headache. But I think that these special exceptions really weaken the bill.
Hillary Shelton, the NAACP is supporting the bill on the whole. You also flag, or the leaders of your organization have also flagged this program, this diversity visa program, which allows a visa lottery for countries that have low levels of immigration. And as Professor Malveaux pointed out, that you know a lot of immigrants from Africa and the Caribbean have taken advantage of this. Overall, why does the NAACP support this bill?
We think it's a good core bill that is going to have to be addressed as we move forward. As you know, as we talk about any piece of legislation passing through the U.S. Congress and making its way to the president's desk, we oftentimes refer to it almost jokingly as a 12-step process. So we're at the beginning of a process. We have a good core bill that does some very helpful things coming out of the Senate. It does need to be fixed, and we have raised issues about diversity visas, immigrants that have had major problems, and actually de facto quotas coming out of Africa and the Caribbean, and the need to address these issues and all of these concerns as we move forward. We were able to put into the Senate bill thus far not only a provision that looks at and begins to raise the issue of increasing those numbers of racial and ethnic minorities from the various places that have been left out and underserved over so many years, but also even a racial profiling provision as to look at the challenges with the federal government as well as local state governments that have now taken it in their own hands to actually put in place their own anti-immigrant policies like Alabama and Arizona. We know that those protections are very well important as well. So we're supporting the bill overall. We're working with those on the House and the Senate side very closely with our friends in the Congressional Black Caucus to craft approaches and amendments to help make this bill what it needs to be to address our folks as well.
Yeah, Professor Malveaux, the bill does make values choices. I mean, it kind of moves the country away from a system of immigration that really favored people with family ties here to a system that really favors people who have higher education, future employment opportunities, may have the ability to create employment opportunities for others. Do you think that that's inherently wrong?
I do. I think that again, the family-based program allowed families to reunify. This employment-based program, which continues the H-1B visa, which I don't think we really need, they're saying essentially they can't find skilled workers in Silicon Valley. That's just not the truth. We have a high unemployment rate among African Americans and among whites, and what some of the work has been done shows that African American students are more likely than white students to major in computer science. So you've got this whole cadre of untouched people who basically are being passed over in favor of folks who are coming through the H-1B program, which until these provisions have been made, which are good provisions, you were basically held like a slave. You could not leave your job. If you were under the H-1B program, you couldn't leave your job because then you would be deported. So this does give people 60 days to find another job. So that's a, you know, the bill has lots of good stuff in it, Michelle, but just also got lots of bad stuff in it. You get extra points if you have degrees in engineering. Of course, African and Caribbean people aren't likely to do that. You get extra points for any number of other things. The only thing that I think Africans are able to benefit from is they usually come here with higher education. But the employability gives you 40 points, higher education gives you 5 points. So, and since employers in Silicon Valley have not gone after African or Caribbean people as employees, they've gone after Indian and Chinese people. All they have to do is require that they also go after African and Caribbean people, and I'd be a little more satisfied. What bothers me the most about this bill is that President Obama says he needs it to be passed as is, because more debate basically will cause more provisions. And I'm sure on the House side, just as on the Senate side, people will have their special provisions. But passing the bill as is just unacceptable.
Mr. Sheldon, what about Julianne Malveaux's point, particularly as a group that has historically dedicated to advancing the interests of African Americans? I mean, I note that the leader of the group, Ben Jealous, makes a comment in his writings about this, that this organization is about equal treatment and social justice, and there's just significant social justice concerns that the NAACP feels morally called upon to advance. But what about the argument that Professor Malveaux is making, that this really kind of suppresses the employment opportunities of native-born African-Americans, even those who are doing everything they can to make themselves competitive in the labor market, in favor of, you know, foreign-born workers? What about her point?
I think she raises a very important point, as a matter of fact, as we look at any tech visa programs, or STEM is the term they're using these days as we talk about the high-tech field, that we have to make sure that as we're securing these visas, that one of the things that's very clearly in place is actually an increase in the cost of these visas to these corporations. If they want to argue, and certainly the Silicon Valley crowd and others argue all the time, that we very well need to make sure we can fill these positions now, and they argue that we don't have people that are prepared for them. Well, if that's the case, then certainly if they need to reach out to bring in someone right now, we have to make sure that the cost is one that actually moves those resources to preparing those in our communities, our HBCUs and other places, to make sure they receive those resources.
But she's saying that the bill makes it less – forgive me. She's saying that the bill makes it less likely that that's going to happen, and I wonder if you think that her point is credible or not.
I think as the bill is written now, she's right. There's less incentive. As a matter of fact, the cost of an H-1B visa in this bill is actually lower than it was before, than it is right now. So that has to be addressed. So in other words, the incentive for corporations to actually look for people right here at home isn't in place, and it's actually devalued with lowering the cost of those H-1Bs. Or they're not calling them H-1Bs now, but the high-tech STEM visas.
Professor Malveaux, we only have a couple minutes left, and so I have a difficult question to ask you, which is that there are those who would argue that your thinking here is itself morally flawed because you are specifically kind of advocating for African Americans, people of African descent, Caribbean people, people of Caribbean descent who are more likely to be black. And that there are some who argue that that's just a kind of a flawed metric, if I can use that term, that that's exactly the kind of thinking we need to get away from when we're thinking about what's best for the country on the whole. Do you mind addressing that?
Sure. I basically support immigration. I support what they call it here, immigration modernization. But let it be modernization for everyone, not just for Latino immigrants who are coming primarily from Mexico, not just for the goodies that South Carolina Senator Graham and Schumer and Rubio and Bennett have thrown into the bill. Let's look at other populations. The fact is that the way we allow people to immigrate has been patently unfair just across the board. Michelle, Canadian people immigrate by walking across the border. And because they're white people, people don't are not subject to the kind of racial profiling that, let's say, a Latino is. The fact is that if we're going to deal with immigration, people want to come to this country. Let's make the opportunity equal.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the immigration bill that's currently being debated and marked up as the term that they use in the Senate. I'm joined by writer and economist Julianne Malvo and Hillary Shelton of the NAACP. Hillary Shelton, a final thought from you?
No, she's absolutely right on so many areas. You know, as we enter this debate over immigration reform, we've had major problems in the African-American community over the slow process of reuniting families, the de facto quotas preventing those of African descent from coming in from Africa and the Caribbean and other places in the basin. In essence, we do have to address all those problems. If it's going to be comprehensive, it has to be fair, it has to be just, and quite frankly, it has to be compassionate as we talk about the diversity that is America and the world, for that matter.
How confident are you that your concerns are being heard by the people who are debating the bill?
Well, we know that we're talking to a number of our friends on the Senate side on a regular basis, the Congressional Black Caucus and many other friends on the House side, and very well hoping to make sure that our issues and concerns carry the day. We're convinced leadership members like Chuck Schumer, like Harry Reid and others are hearing us, and we're seeing actually the result of those conversations and amendments that are being crafted even as we speak.
Hillary Shelton is the Washington Bureau Director for the NAACP. He was with us from member station WYPR in Baltimore. Julianne Malvo is a writer and economist. She was with us from member station WLRN in Miami. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
It's great being with you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, kidnapping survivor Elizabeth Smart spoke out earlier this week about lessons she hopes others will learn from her ordeal, including how to talk to young women about sex. We'll speak with a writer and blogger who shares Smart's Mormon faith about this in just a few minutes. But first, more on that harrowing story out of Cleveland. Three women are returning to their families after allegedly being held captive for years. Amanda Berry is one of them. Back in 2003, her disappearance made headlines in Cleveland. But as you might expect, after a while, a lot of people moved on. But moving on was never an option for Amanda's mother, Luana Miller. She made regular pitches and visits to journalists, one of which was Regina Brett, who is a columnist with The Plain Dealer in Cleveland. Regina talked with Ms. Miller many times over the years until her death in 2006. And Regina Brett is with us now. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Michelle, thanks for covering this story.
You paint a very vivid picture of Luana Miller in your column about how she never gave up. I mean, how did your relationship with her start?
You know, how it started was she called me on the phone and said, "How come you're not covering this story?" We had had a small story because I think initially everybody thought it might just be a child running away because she was 16. So we didn't play it very large in the paper. We wrote a story about it, but Luana called me and said, "You need to come over here." So I drove over to her house on West 111th, walked up the steps. I walked in her home, and she screamed at me, "Close the blankety-blank door." And I walked in, and the room was full of cigarette smoke, and she was sitting there angry. And it wasn't what I expected. You know, on TV, you always see the mother crying and soft-spoken, wanting her daughter back. Luana was like a mother bear, and she wanted to find who had her daughter and get that child back. She was fierce in her love for her daughter. She called her Mandy. She called Amanda Mandy. And Luana just never gave up. You know, I wrote five columns on Amanda missing over the span of the couple years that Luana was alive. And Luana would call me often and say, yell at me, "How come you're not doing more? How come you're not doing more?" And it broke my heart, but there's nothing new to say. And I felt terrible saying that to a mother, that there are no new facts and there's no new information. But I couldn't write the same column because nothing had changed. And it was heartbreaking. She lived with such pain over this.
You said, you wrote in one of your columns, "I dreaded every phone call because her pain was so great. Nothing I said or wrote could diminish it."
I really wanted to find Amanda. I would walk from Burger King, where she was missing, to that house and rack my brain over what do we not cover. You know, we interviewed everybody we could. There are posters everywhere about her missing, yellow ribbons. And, you know, I just didn't know, but I really believed that she'd been taken because Luana kept saying she had $100 on her dresser. She would have taken the money if she ran away. She was in her Burger King uniform. No teenager runs away wearing a Burger King uniform.
Yeah, you write about that in your column. I found that fascinating, too. You said, she said, look, no teenager would leave $100 on her dresser. No teenager would leave without taking her phone charger. No teenager would leave the day before her 17th birthday party. No teenager would run away wearing a Burger King uniform. Do you think that she felt that people didn't believe her?
You know, I think she felt, from what Luana shared with me, was that, one, they weren't doing enough, and two, that they just assumed that she had run away. And the hard part of all this is that when a teenager is missing, it isn't always treated the same as if it's a child missing. We don't expect children of 5 and 6 years old to run away. But when a child's a teenager, 14, 15, 16, 17, and they go missing, the first thing people think of is, well, did they run away? And I think we have to, right now, from here on out, look at every teenager missing as an endangered child. There are so many people preying on women, especially teenagers, that every child gone missing should be an Amber Alert. I don't care if they're 14, 15, 16, because there are people like this man who's been charged that are out there preying on young girls.
You know, as we mentioned, she passed away in 2006. What sort of emotional and physical toll do you think that this ordeal had on her?
You know, I look at Luana, and every time I talk to her, she the pain never stopped. I mean, every time we talked, she was angry, she cried, her heart was broken. I talked to her sister the other day, Diana, and she said that they would go out to a restaurant, and Luana would leave in the middle of the meal and say, I can't eat, I don't know if Mandy's eating. I mean, she never stopped thinking about her every day, wondering, did she eat today? Is she asleep somewhere? Is she cold? You know, is she hurt? She never stopped thinking daily about her daughter. And I think that took its toll on her heart. They said she died of heart failure. She was 43, and I really believe she died of a broken heart.
Do you, you know, you actually mentioned that she actually reached out to a psychic for help at one point, and the psychic told her that Amanda was no longer alive and that she would see her in heaven. And I wonder if you have thoughts about what effect that might have had on her, or is she as tough with her as she was with everybody else who didn't believe in her quest?
You know, she went to the psychic. It was Sylvia Brown, and I was on the Montel Williams show. And Luana thought she's going to give the answers. And Luana was doing her own private eye work. She put up her own posters with her own phone number. And I said, Luana, you need them to call the FBI, not you. And she said, but the FBI is not doing enough. And I said, but you're going to lose the leads. You're going to lose the information if it just comes to you. And so she did everything she could. The last result, I mean, the last effort was seeing the psychic. And when Sylvia Brown said to her, you're not going to see your daughter again. You know, your daughter's, I think she said she was either, she visualized her underwater or somehow deceased. And that just killed Alana. I mean, she just thought, oh my God, it can't be true. I mean, and I think that's when she really, if she ever gave up, that was the tipping point.
But, you know, it's interesting. Authorities have called Amanda Berry the true hero in this case. I mean, they said that from the beginning. They said if she had not, for whatever reason, she had the strength to break free and led to the rescue of the two other young women. Knowing Luana as you came to know her, you think that maybe she got that from her.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've never met a woman like Luana Miller. She's an old-fashioned, you know, whiskey-drinking, chain-smoking, don't get in the way of my daughter and me. You know, you're going to have to pay. I mean, she was tough, really tough. I mean, I was afraid of her, to be honest.
Really?
I was because she would yell at me. I mean, nobody yells at a reporter that they want a story from, you know? I mean,
well, what would she say?
Oh, she'd swear at me, you know, God damn it, how come you're not doing enough? You know, she's been missing, and you haven't written about this in a while, and nobody cares about her, and I knew nobody cared as much as Luana did. I mean, she would yell at the FBI. She threw them out of her house.
She threw the FBI out of her house?
Yeah, she threw the FBI out, the Cleveland police. I mean, Luana was so tough that, you know, she smoked a little pot to ease the pain, and she had us sitting out one day, and she didn't care. She said, if the police want to arrest me, go for it. I mean, she was just tough. She was her own woman. But boy, did she love her Mandy. I mean, she loved her so much. They were more than just mother-daughter. I think to Luana, Mandy was like her best friend, you know. They were like sisters.
Before we let you go, we only have about a minute left. I mean, it must be, I don't know, heartbreaking in a way, bittersweet to know that Amanda is free, but her mother, who fought so hard for her, isn't here to see it. I don't know. What do you think she would say? I know it's a terrible question, but what do you think she would say?
I don't know what she'd say, but I was out at the scene today. I was out at the scene on Seymour Avenue. I've been out there on and off all week. And I see all the satellite trucks. Everybody's there. The BBC from Scotland and France are calling me. And every major network, and Luana always complained that her daughter never got any national coverage. She goes, I need national coverage. And I look at the scene and all the people covering this, and I think, Luana has got to be laughing now saying, see, I told you so.
She sure
did. The founder.
Regina Brett is a columnist for The Plain Dealer, author of the book Be the Miracle, 50 Lessons for Making the Impossible Possible, How Appropriate. She joined us by phone from her home office in Cleveland. Regina, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
We are going to stay with this story for a few more minutes. And this is a question you might have asked yourself. Some people are wondering how it is that three women could be held captive for a decade. Why didn't they try to run away? Well, that's a question very few people can answer with personal knowledge. But one person who can is Elizabeth Smart, the young Utah girl who was kidnapped from her bedroom back in 2002 and held for 9 months, during which time she was repeatedly raped. Now she's an activist speaking out against human trafficking. And at a forum earlier this month, she offered some pointed comments about the question we asked earlier. Here she is.
She said, imagine you're a stick of gum, and when you engage in sex, that's like getting chewed. And then if you do that lots of times, you're going to become an old piece of gum. And who's going to want you after that?
She's speaking about a teacher that she had who was talking about having premarital sex. And those comments struck a nerve with Christine Haglund. She is the editor of Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. She is a lifelong practicing Mormon, and she wrote about it on the blog By Common Consent. Christine Haglund, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
In your response to Elizabeth Smart's comments, you wrote that you were disheartened to learn that she'd heard this chewed gum analogy. And you say, quote, I'm willing to bet it was from a seminary or church teacher, or at least a Mormon school teacher. Why did you say that?
Because I know many Mormon women who have heard stories like this in church. They're not from official manuals, but they come up in the culture. My sister heard about an analogy of a plate of cookies that the teacher smashed and then put dirt on and said, now who wants a cookie? So I know that these object lessons get used by teachers who are well-intentioned and wanting to protect kids and help them be safe. And I have teenagers, so I can understand the sort of desperation that would lead you to pick the most viscerally horrifying analogy you could think of to try to scare them straight, as it were. But this is not official teaching, and it's dangerous and harmful, as Elizabeth's talk clearly showed.
You said that, you know, this is not part of official teaching anymore, particularly the idea that if a person is raped, that somehow her chastity, her virtue has been taken from her, and she somehow meant to feel shame and responsibility for that. But you also note that all Mormon girls follow a personal progress manual. When this is where they set out and follow personal and spiritual goals, and you said that this teaches a lot of good things, but there's a reference that's in the very first lesson that you're concerned about. This is what, from Moroni 9:9, which describes young women of having lost their virtue, you know, in a time of war after having been raped. And you're saying that this shouldn't be there now. This should just be gone. Tell us a little bit more about that, if you would.
You know, scriptures are always messy. They're difficult. They need context. And in the Mormon church particularly, we believe in continuing revelation, which means that the scriptures can be officially reinterpreted and understood in new ways. And so one current official statement about abuse says this. It says, victims of sexual abuse are not guilty of sin and do not need to repent. If you've been a victim of abuse, know that you are innocent and that God loves you. Talk to your parents or another trusted adult and seek your bishop's counsel. They can support you spiritually and assist you in getting the protection and help you need. The process of healing may take time. Trust in Jesus. He will heal you and give you peace. So the official message is this beautiful, clear statement that rape or abuse does not rob one of chastity or virtue. But we have these scriptures that come from a different time. And I think that reading those scriptures is a very useful thing. I'm not saying we should excise, you know, this verse from the canon, but the way that it comes up in the youth curriculum is in this personal progress manual that girls do largely independently. And so it just says, read and study this. And there's no context given. There's no adult who would necessarily be in the room talking a girl through this scripture. And you can just imagine what it would be like for a young girl who had been abused or raped to confront this and not have any way of understanding that it comes from an older culture and we don't believe this anymore. You know, it just, I don't think that kids should encounter scriptures like that alone.
You make two points here. One is that the clergy in the LDS Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is a lay clergy, that there's no one central place where everybody gets their sort of teaching. So there's that piece. But you also said that this is a microaggression, that it's still prevalent and destructive. Could you talk a little bit more about what you meant there?
Because it's a lay clergy and also because it is run by a patriarchy, there are a lot of ways that girls' and women's experiences are not well understood or not considered in matters of curriculum, just because there aren't, you know, necessarily women in the room when those discussions are happening. So there are lots of tiny things. There are stories about modesty and about the importance of, you know, keeping your shoulders covered, because clearly, you know, tank tops are some sort of gateway drug to promiscuity. And these small little shaming references about girls and women's bodies are still present. And they, you know, it's not just a Mormon problem. This comes in conservative religious culture generally. But Mormonism has, I think, a particularly difficult time filtering them out because of this lay clergy.
What response have you gotten to this column? I mean, in reading the comments, I saw a lot of people immediately saying, amen, right on, thank you for raising this issue. But I also saw people criticizing you for raising this in a public forum. And I'm wondering if you think some people are interpreting this as an attack on the religion.
Yes. It's definitely not the tone that a nice Mormon girl would address church leaders in. And in truth, I wrote it in about 5 minutes. And, you know, the danger of blogs is that you can hit publish before you hear your mother's voice in your head saying, count to 10. You know, sorry, Mom. So part of it was just that tone, that sort of direct and forceful tone is not what people expect when we're talking about problems in the church. And then the other thing is that Mormons are a proselyting religion and concerned to spread this message that they find joyful and hopeful to everyone. And there's a fear that talking about any problem in the church will make people think that the church isn't something good, or that people will be turned away from Mormonism by any public criticism.
Well, how do you feel now that you've put this statement out here? And I'm also particularly interested in Elizabeth Smart's decision to speak publicly about this. I mean, is she someone that you think people will listen to? And when she put this in such a powerful way?
Yeah, I think she is. It would be interesting to know for sure, you know, whether that teacher was Mormon. And it was very interesting that she talked about it in the context of school and not the church. You know, she didn't directly indict Mormon culture. You know, it would be interesting to know if she would, see this as partly a Mormon problem. But yes, I think she has an important voice. She's a remarkable, remarkable woman.
What about you? How do you feel now that you put this point of view out there? Do you feel that people are listening? Do you feel that you've changed the conversation?
I don't know. The church usually doesn't change in response to public pressure, and especially not public pressure from critical members. I don't think it's probably the most productive way to have gone about it. It was an expression of frustration more than a constructive attempt to make change. And I regret that a little bit. I do think that forthright conversation is one of the most important things we can do. And in a church where, you know, the central hierarchy is far removed from most members, there really isn't an opportunity to give feedback or to talk to anyone official and say, hey, this is a problem. Could we address it?
Christine Haglund is the editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. She was kind enough to join us from Boston. Christine, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we want to tell you about a new film whose premise will be familiar to just about anybody who's ever been in a relationship. At some point, the question arises, when am I going to meet your family? And boy, can that be awkward.
This is Wade Walker, everybody.
Guilty.
Yeah, and he's my friend.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah. And also, we are in a relationship.
Excuse me, a relationship?
Dad, I'm sure I mentioned I was seeing a Wade.
No, I don't remember that.
That was Kerry Washington, whom you may have seen in a hit ABC show Scandal, as well as last year's controversial film Django Unchained, taking a very different role as Grace Peoples in the new comedy Peoples. Craig Robinson, whom you also know from The Office, plays her longtime boyfriend Wade Walker, who for some reason Grace has not seen fit to introduce to her family until he takes matters into his own hands and decides to crash her family reunion. As they say, hijinks ensue. The film opens in theaters tomorrow, and director Tina Gordon Chisholm is with us. She's a veteran writer and now making her directing debut with the film. Welcome to you and congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be at NPR. Thank you.
How did you get the idea for the film? And as I said, this is a premise that I'm sure will be familiar to a lot of people. So, you know, I'm going to ask if this happened to you.
I was dating a guy and he was perfect. And then the moment came where I had to meet his family and I'm looking at pictures of them. And that's where the idea for in the film, the chocolate Kennedys, came from, because I looked at them and they were just perfect. And it just seemed impenetrable. I was like, how am I going to relate to these people? And everything stayed perfect the entire weekend. But I would see cracks in the family. And when I tried to have an honest conversation with the family, they were totally in denial. I just found that as a writer so funny. And that's the beginnings of Peoples. Really, what I wanted to talk about is unconditional love and how we can't be safe in our families to not be perfect. Where can we be?
I'm dying to know who you base the character of Grace's dad on.
Judge Virgil Peoples is definitely inspired by a real man. I asked him to do a cameo, but to him it was in just poor taste, Tina, and he would not do it.
Well, that's so funny to me, because in fact, in the film, we don't have a clip of that, but in the film, when Wade tries to call him Mr., it's always Judge.
Yes,
no, it's
exactly.
Judge. It's Judge, which is a little like having your daughter's boyfriend call you Congressman.
Exactly. It was just sort of the formality of the real Virgil Peoples. That was a nod to him, but he's not my father, but he's a very accomplished, very powerful African-American father, family man, husband. And I just was at dinner with a friend. It was not even someone I was dating, but he considered that that was someone I was dating. And throughout the entire dinner, he would whisper in my ear about why this person was so unsuitable for me to be with. And I just remember thinking, this would be the worst father to bring someone home to.
Well, you know, one of the other things that we noticed, and your film career was originally about writing. You started as an intern in the writing department of The Cosby Show, and you went on to write the films Drumline and ATL. One of the reasons I'm interested in this is Drumline and The Cosby Show take place in kind of a very black space.
Yes.
And one of the interesting things about this film is that these characters clearly live very mainstream, upper middle class lives. And yes. I was curious about how important was that to you, to kind of put them in a context where, yes, they're still an African-American family, but they live a very kind of she-she
right.
existence.
The issue of class, it really wasn't something that I overtly was setting out to represent in the film. What I learned from Dr. Cosby when I worked there was that he felt, whether the house had eight bedrooms or one bedroom, whatever, that fundamentally, if you're writing a comedy, you have to deliver the comedy, obviously, but use that opportunity to show the culture as well. So I tried to also add that texture in the production of Peoples. So it's a mix. You know, I wanted to show that they were strivers and that they worked hard and were educated and obviously were high achieving, but also have a sense of the culture that they came from, that they always knew had a cultural reference. And so I tried to do that in the art.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the new comedy film Peoples with director Tina Gordon Chisholm. Speaking of high achieving, you know, you've got David Alan Greer in the cast. You've got Kerry Washington, who's, you know, hot, hot, hot. Craig Robinson playing her love interest. You also have Diane Carroll and Melvin Van Peebles playing other roles. I've got to ask, as a first-time director,
yes,
a little intimidating?
A lot intimidating. You are at the mercy of the cast, and they just rallied around me. They loved the script. They all came to play and give their best. So that was a huge relief. But on day one, that was Diane Carroll and Melvin Van Peebles' day. I just remember having a meltdown, thinking, why did I not catch that day one is Mel. Like, it didn't hit me because I was so busy until I was en route to the set. And then it started snowing, and I had to reblock everything as I'm driving there. Just snowflakes start falling, and I'm thinking, oh my God, we can't be outside. We have to be inside, and Diane Carroll is there. I'm going to have a meltdown. And when I got to set, Diane Carroll sort of stopped everything and made the most incredible speech about how excited she was to play this, as she would call it, very modern, you know, sort of frisky grandmother. And she was also excited to play with African-American actors that she felt made really smart career choices that she had actually followed as a fan and was excited to play along beside them. And I really, really think she and Melvin Van Peebles, because they grounded that first day and they set the tone in a way that I couldn't, and it was totally me standing on their shoulders and their experience in that moment, and I was able to move out after that. So I'm grateful to them.
Well, another person who clearly had confidence in you was Tyler Perry. I mean, the film comes from Lionsgate, but Tyler Perry's production company, 34th Street Film, in fact, we have a clip of him talking about the project and why he decided that he would work with you on it, and here it is.
Giving this person an opportunity who had written here and written there, but having the opportunity to write and direct your own movie, I know what that feels like. So if I could use 34th Street to take her life and lift her and elevate her and give her a platform to do some great things, then I wanted to be in. And to watch Tina as director stress out and pull her hair out, I was thinking, oh, okay, this is pretty cool.
That's Tyler. That's funny.
Kind of mean.
Yeah, thanks for talking.
What did he mean by that? What was he talking about? What was he talking about there, Tina?
He showed up on set on something called Moby Dick Day in the movie. And I have so much to do that day. It was all the cast. It was a big day. It was a big production. And he was talking to me, and I was just like, what? You know, like, there was no deference or respect. I'm like, listen, sit down. I'll talk to you in a minute. but it was fun to see him sit on the side and watch. And I thought, okay, I can't be Tyler Perry. I can only be myself. And luckily, he did not want me to be Tyler Perry. He wanted me to be Tina. And he just stood back. And he's like, I want to see what happens. And that's what he did.
Well, speaking of standing back and seeing what happens, how did you come upon the idea of Kerry Washington for the role of Grace Peebles? I understand that that was your idea. Am I right about that?
Yeah, it was
really
my
wanted
first
her?
Idea.
And I think a lot of people might be puzzled by that, because the things that they've seen her in recently are really serious. I mean, they're For Color Girls and Scandal, which is scandalous. And, of course, Django Unchained, which was a very controversial film last year.
Yes.
Very brutal to watch, very sort of difficult to watch. How did you get the idea that she could do comedy?
Really, when I'm writing, I never think of actual actors. They're always these sort of people in my mind that aren't actors. And it's sort of close to the end of the final draft, as I'm tinkering on it, actors start popping in. And the first actor to pop in was Kerry Washington. She likes to know the details behind every choice she makes as an actor. I didn't know this about her. I didn't know her personally, but I just sort of gleaned this from her, from just watching her or observing her socially. And I thought, if I could get Kerry to sort of make fun of this type A perfectionism that I believe her to have, then that will be a likable Grace Peebles, because she has to be high achieving. You have to feel like she is striving to be at her father's level in terms of accomplishment and achievement. But you want to like her at the same time. And I just thought Kerry could pull that off perfectly if she could make fun of it. And she was more than game to have fun. So it worked out perfectly.
I want to play one more clip from the film. And one of the reasons that, again, I just want to show that this is the kind of situation that I think a lot of people will relate to, where somebody really wants to impress the dad. The setup in this film is that Craig Robinson, who plays Wade, is really trying to impress Virgil, who plays, you know, Kerry Washington's father, Grace, and is kind of the patriarch of this clan. And he's facing off with him a number of times, as a potential sons-in-law will do. And finally, Wade wants to see if they can... You got to follow me here if you haven't seen the film,
off?
But the sweat off,
the sweat
off. Yes, we're talking about the sweat off, where for Virgil, for reasons which I cannot explain here, is in this sweat lodge, and Wade is determined to try to keep up with him, and I'll just play that clip, and here it is.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, you heard the chief.
walk through the flame into manhood.
But it's supposed to scare me? You think this is hot? This ain't nothing but July in my bedroom growing up.
More colds.
A lot more. I'm an iceberg. Glassy eyes.
I'm a 44-ounce big gulp.
Wade in the water.
I'm an iceberg.
Wade in the water, children. Wade can't make it without water.
I'm a cold pitcher of Grand Kool-Aid with a smiley face on it.
Now I'm just thinking, we've got the two African-American men in a sweat lodge, in a Native American sweat lodge on Moby Dick weekend in the Hamptons. Okay, so
happens all the time, But I have to say, about Moby Dick, people ask me, like, whalers, black people, I'm confused, like, what's going on? Well, I will tell you that I was in Sag Harbor, and I discovered that there was a bustling whaling community, and I also found out that fugitive slaves were whalers, and I thought, whaler, black, Moby Dick, I see the
logic. I'm so there. But let me ask you this, Tina, question. I have to ask this question. Is it part of it? It has long been sort of a kind of an understanding or kind of unspoken that dramas are racially mixed, but comedies tend to be segregated. Are you kind of hoping that maybe you can break that pattern once and for all?
I am. African-American actors that have been in mainstream films that are so funny, but they might not have had the biggest role. You know, Craig in The Office, their comedic chops, what they think is funny. It's present in people's. It isn't all black cast, but I feel like the relatability of the plot, the comedy and the music present in it, I promise that they'll have a good time. We've seen the movie, white audiences, black audiences, brown audiences, and it has really translated. So that makes me happy above all. Laughter, I feel like, breaks through a lot of that.
Tina Gordon Chisholm is the writer and director of the new film Peoples. It opens in theaters tomorrow, and we caught up with her at NPR West in Culver City, California. Tina Gordon Chisholm, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations.
I really appreciate this. This was fun. Thank you so much, NPR.
Now we turn to a segment we call In Your Ear. Sometimes after we've asked our guests about their work, we ask them about the music they listen to while they relax or play. Today we hear from Ambassador Ron Kirk. He recently stepped down as United States Trade Representative, but we caught up with him shortly before he left his post, and here's what he had to say about the music that kept him moving.
Right now, I'm enjoying Once in a Lifetime by Smokey Norville.
As a little boy, I used to dream of the big stage. Couldn't wait to see my name in lights.
Really think he's one of the more gifted vocalists of our time. Powerful voice.
The closer I'd get, the more distant I'd feel. The more I thought I had, the less it all seemed real. Suddenly I found the only thing for me that counts, and I can't imagine my life without you.
I mean, the basic lyrics about it, how at one point in his life all he wanted to do was be famous, to be well known, you know, to be popular, to be wealthy, and then come into a realization that having peace and joy in your own life, some relationship with a higher being, can give you most of what you wished for.
And once in a lifetime, you find joy you can't replace. I used to think that it was the trophies on my wall. Thought if I'd won, then I'd...
Look.
My kids make fun of me because I don't remember the words to anything. And I love to sing. I get everything wrong. Growing up, they loved no more than listening to my tortured version of Eminem's, you know, you gotta move it, you lose it, you never let it go, you know, you only get one shot to rock or something. But I like the song. I just don't bother with the lyrics.
And I'll has to go through three stages for its all to run. It has to go through the shaking, the beating.
I have to start every day with gospel. It just gets me going. It gets me inspired, and it prepares me, particularly in an environment like Washington that can be so toxic. It allows me to approach every day that things are going to come, but things always come. And you know what? I got through it yesterday. I'll get through it today with the proper frame of mind. And it just, I have my own little praise party every morning while I'm getting ready. And that way I can walk in here and hopefully have the right light, the right energy to inspire everybody else to go out and do the work we have to do.
If it had not been for the pressing, I wouldn't be able to walk into my destiny.
That last song is Greater Is Coming by Ja'Kalen Carr. And that was Ambassador Ron Kirk. To hear my earlier conversation with him, go to npr.org/tellmemore. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
I trust in the Lord. I trust in the Lord. You're preparing.